Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Digital Artcast. Firing high off the heels of the last one. I think real people enjoyed and engaged with Darren's kind of talk and what he was aiming on about the state of the industry. But we're kind of zeroing back into our kind of bread and butter on the podcast, which is artists and developers in the games industry. Artists specifically for this episode. Someone who's joining the Two Times Club, because this will be his second appearance on the podcast. Yeah. We're bringing in today a concept artist, environment artist, art director, man of many talents, Mr. Tim Kaminsky. He's coming back to the podcast. Hello, Tim. How are you doing?
Hello. How's it going? It's glad to be back. It feels like it's been like a whole chapter of my life that has gone by since we've last talked. It feels maybe even longer than it actually was, but I suppose there's been a lot happening since we last talked in the podcast.
If you think about it, so we last talked in 2018, I think, was like,
it's a completely different world now.
Yeah, like, because that was even post COVID. It was post, like, you know, most things in America, to be fair, like, you know. And yeah, it just feels like, especially now with the layoffs, like, and the way the industry is now, like, the landscape 6 years later, you know, it's
It feels a little bit like a landmine, with the landmine field, with all the different layoffs and everything happening everywhere.
The last time we got you on, I think you were just like almost like on the cusp of leaving where you were originally to go live in LA and work at Wonderstorm. Where are you from originally, again?
Originally I'm from Michigan, but I've jumped around. I've been everywhere. I've been like living in Chicago and Georgia. I think the last, where I was before was South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And I think when we talked, I had literally just moved. I remember being in my new apartment and we had a chat. I think I was in El Segundo in LA.
Right.
It was right down the road from my studio that I just had joined, Wonderstorm.
And now you've left Wonderstorm. So can you tell the guys really quickly where you are now and what you're doing?
Yeah. Now I'm at Robot Entertainment, working on a new project. Robot Entertainment, they've been most known for Orcs Must Die franchise, and they've got three of those out. And actually, technically, there was four. Three games. And then previously, the studio mostly came from Ensemble Studio. So it was like your Age of Empires and Age of Mythology. So kind of a lot of those core people from that team are the leadership at Robot Entertainment now. Like, they all worked on those games and kind of split off and created Robot. And I think there was some other studios that split off from Ensemble at that point.
And what are you doing there currently?
I am the art director on a new project that we're working on. Really excited to get it released and everything. Announcing that, you know, in the next while.
At one point in time.
I can't really say.
It will come out at some point. Yeah, let PR handle that.
You'll see me probably messaging all over my socials, which I haven't been too active on lately because I've been quite busy with life and art and art directing and work and such.
I mean, I think just the roller coaster you've been on the last couple of years, I think you've just almost retreated inwards and took some time to yourself, right?
Yeah, I before I was pretty active on social media and stuff like that, and I took a step back. I felt like it wasn't like very, I was
serving you well,
not in a good space mentally, and my mental health wasn't in a great space. So I kind of took a step back and kind of refocused on just enjoying my life a little bit more. Cause I think my work life balance and social media life balance was a little bit off. So I started to just appreciate, you know, sometimes not doing things for a little bit, which I'm pretty bad at.
Knee deep in stuff, try to get things done. Yeah.
Even when I take a break from doing things, I'm always like, I find another thing to kind of like tackle on to. Like, I mean, when I'm not drawing, I got a piano, so now I'm learning music and I play piano and stuff.
I was just thinking that's funny though, because we were literally just talking about that the other week, you know, because we've been friends for so long. I was talking about, you know, you were looking to get your teeth into something again, and I was like, oh yeah, my servers, you know, they're a small indie dev, like they could use help. And you're like, oh yeah, like I'll totally art direct another project or I'll help with another thing. But like, yeah, so it's, I know, it is a difficult balance. And the thing we'll probably dive into is, you know, how social media is affecting us as artists, how I feel like it has changed. And, you know, we don't have to do the usual bullshit, like, because you know, we've talked to you about your career. That was the whole thing in 2018. We talked about where you came from, your indie dev scene, and building your own games, and then getting into what you do.
Yeah.
So it's a thing now where we look at how the landscape has changed. Now, socials in general, I think it's like a dumpster fire at the moment. You know, there's Instagram, Facebook, and everything else. You know, I can name them all, but I'd be here all day.
There's so many of them, yeah. It's like hard to know which one to use. And
the reach as well. I mean, I've seen people who have like a million followers on their account and their posts are averaging like maybe like 50,000 likes, engagement, something like that. You know, maybe 100,000 that'll push.
Yeah, I've seen a dramatic drop in engagement. And I'm, I don't know if it's accurate numbers, but I guess the internet is like, what, 30% humans and the rest is not. So robots, I kind of think bots have taken over a lot of these.
Someone talked about that, about Facebook, and they were talking about how because there's so many bot accounts on Facebook through various means, but mostly political stuff, where, as we well know now, how Russia was involved with the American government's you're setting up with the whole thing with Trump. It's a thing where like you find some sites and some groups where it's like bots answering questions and then bots answering those questions but in a direct response that's opposite, so then they're fighting with each other, and then just it's this endless chain of people fighting with bots fighting with people.
It makes it look like this whole thing's happening and it's just bots arguing over stuff. But one of the things, I know a little bit of a tangent for AI, but when it was starting to come out, I was like, oh, it's probably gonna start eating and consuming itself. And Facebook is a great example of seeing that, because there's like bots posting images that are created by bots that look, they don't even like look believable, but bots are liking them. So it's like this weird circle of just chaos and nonsense.
I think it's a positive for us as artists, because what I feel like the loop is going to end up doing is, because we talked about this when we had Darren on in the last episode, where if you look at where the people have landed in AI, it's the same people that came from NFTs and then moved to crypto and then moved to AI. So it's like the snake oil thing. It's like, you know, I think because that is essentially going to, like you said, the snake eating its own tail, it's the thing of people will get so burnt out in that stuff that in like a year or two, they will really seek out people like yourself and me and other people who like make good content.
Yeah, that's kind of what I hope, is that, that it, people get tired of things that aren't made by humans, and then it brings back around that like need for humans. It might be a little while. Usually those cycles seem like they're like 10, 20, and 30 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe sometimes five, like seems like things kind of speed up along
those. I think people are just burnt out in the internet. Like I think the whole thing is like being online, especially during COVID, because that's all you could do. You had to be inside. You had to be online because there was nothing else to do.
Yeah.
You know, and Darren talked about it as well. And he was, you know, he's a recruiter. I'm not saying he's not an artist in what he does, but like he, in recruitment, even knew that the thing that AI was lacking, and where we like, I clapped at the end, he was like, you know, it has no soul. It has no like warmness to it. And I was like, yeah, like it is missing that human element. That's the thing that makes it art, is the soul of the thing that you pour into.
Yeah, it's the experiences of the individual and their life and the elements they instill in that. Like when I'm working with a team, like I try to draw that out as much as I can. Like I don't want to like be like, oh, it's got to be just like this. I kind of leave an open area of like, oh, what can you do? And then I always get surprised in great ways where it's like, oh, that's a really great idea. Or like they'll put some of themselves in there, or the knowledge that they know from where they came from. So you always have like a unique perspective. And just because you know everything from like a AI side doesn't mean it's going to be better, let alone the purpose of like concept art and stuff isn't being solved by AI. It's problem solving, spatial awareness and things like that, that don't get resolved at all.
As of the time we're recording this, Feng Zhu has just put out a huge video, like an hour and a half long, of how AI will not steal your jobs, because he sees that, you know, it can make the pretty picture at the moment, but it can't do the problem solving aspect of, you know, taking like a vertical slice of something and then breaking it apart into like, well, how does this function? How does the door open? How does the hinge, you know, like, because, you know, it's like you can't hand a landscape painting to a 3D artist and be like, go. They'll be like, right, this is cool, but how does this thing work? How does this thing, when you turn it around, like, you know, like even stuff like turnarounds where people have, I remember talking to two concept art students 3 weeks ago, and I was reviewing their portfolio, and I said, you've got a lot of like, what we call keyframe shots or key shots, where it's like, you know, you're looking at the landscape thing. Yeah. I think obviously with stuff like films, that usually plays a big part because you want a good visual identity in what you're going to film.
Yeah, like establishing shots and stuff.
Yeah, but with games, because everything's so functional driven, everything has to have a function and a drive. I was like, this is cool that you built this weapon, but like, and the render shots are really cool and lights and stuff. And your camera lots and stuff like that, but like, how does the reload chamber work? Like, how does the thing, you know, how do they get the clip in? Does the sight turn round? Can this bit be taken off? And they're like, oh, I never thought about that. And I was like, maybe if you'd done like a 3/4 as well, and maybe like showed the bit with the guardrails on, because that would be hard to model. You may want to break that bit apart and maybe like pull it off the model, then a whole like thing. Like, stuff like that, they're just not thinking about. And that's the thing where people, I think, through art books and ArtStation have been like almost poisoned, because they think like this now, that that's what concept art is.
Yeah, there's a lot of people think illustration is concept art, so they fill their portfolio with like really beautifully rendered, immaculate illustrations, like character illustrations and things like that. But it's like, oh, it's, you know, these aren't really the like nitty gritty kind of sketches and ideas and process and
nothing that would feed into a pipeline, basically.
No. And then like for like environment side, like our environment concept artists work so closely with the art team too, mm-hmm. where it's like, oh, I did this concept, and then like the 3D artist will block it out and be like, well, how does that feel from like the player's perspective when they run around? And it becomes a feel thing. Like there's the composition elements as well, but it kind of comes down to like, oh, if the player is going to be playing in the space when they look up or down or over here, what do they see? How do we draw their attention? And, you know, right now, yeah, I can't do any of that stuff. So,
yeah, that's definitely a weak point, especially when it comes to things like level design, because that's like a whole department that takes over from stuff like that and then makes the space playable, you know, interactable, you know.
Yeah. The big thing I see, I know we're probably out of tangent AI, big thing is people that don't understand art mm-hmm. being like, use AI. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, you don't understand the purpose of this. Like you're so far removed from it, and the artists are so deep into it that they can't even hardly talk to each other or understand each other, where it's like, oh yeah, look, it made beautiful pictures. You could use it. It's like, yeah, it makes beautiful pictures, but like
not functional.
They're not functional. And on top of that, like the legitimacy of it, like
of making
kind of don't know if like in a few years, if like a band hammer will fall down and be like, oh, all of that content is actually theirs.
Yeah.
Which is hopefully what will happen. But
yeah. It's thinking back to even the thing that I was talking about back in like, oh God, like 2014 or something. And people used to say that they would open art books and look at concept art, as we now know it as marketing art. But like, yeah, like people would look at those big establishment shots and say, oh yeah, concept art, like the blue sky stuff. And I'm like, I mean, maybe like in the first, I don't even know, like 3 months of a project, maybe you're making like big bold strokes where it's like, this is kind of what the thing will look like. Maybe the purple sky, green grass, whatever. But then after that, you then have to dig into the hard bit, which is like, right,
yeah.
Atmosphere, how does it feel, what inhabits the world, what the creature's like. That's the stuff that, you know, again, we talked about this yesterday, how a lot of these AI guys think that an idea man is a job in the industry.
Yeah. When it's really got ideas, but who can like coordinate and implement, discuss and, you know, communicate those ideas.
Yeah. Even ideas wise, I mean, like you can always, you know, raise your hand and put your input, but by the time the creative director has got past that point of making the game design document, like a lot of stuff is pretty established. You're not going to be throwing even more stuff on top of it unless it really needs it.
Yeah. So. And usually the idea people, it ends up becoming scope creep. And it's like, well, we have a team size of this. It's going to cost us this much. We have this much time. And yeah, like you're saying, the blue sky stuff, like that's all the pre-production, but happens pretty quickly. Some projects are pre-production longer, but usually you go roll right into production and then you're immediately like, oh, here's level blockouts. We've got to make these look like this and
start making texture passes and stuff like
that. You're not making like beautiful pictures and stuff. Like once in a while, you'll have some time where be like, oh, let's render this one out as kind of like a shot to show the team to get them
like
excited.
Advertising as well. You might put it out in your socials or something and say, here's a sneak peek at
that too.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's just for internal at first to kind of get people excited.
So and the team gets an idea.
Yeah. And then you can be like, oh, we'll use this piece later for maybe marketing. We might render it up a little bit more. But
and then even then, like a something like you or me and the art director, but like a production artist would probably spend like a good couple hours just making it even better, you know, like making it a bit more believable, a bit more like, oh, here's like birds for scale, you know, stuff like that. Birds
for scale. I literally did that the other day. Like I was taking a screenshot of some of our levels and I was like, these look really great, but we haven't had time for the VFX artist to get in there and give us some birds for scale yet. So I was just like, bloop, 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 little W's and V's. And, and I even didn't even notice it after a little bit. Everyone's just like, there's birds in there.
You think about how the way back and, you know, the things we used to think about even in production where, you know, birds for scale and round brush and stuff is, you know, how far we've come now. But
Stickman, birds for scale.
Yeah, indeed. So, But yeah, so, I mean, you were doing Wonderstorm and you were working on Dragon Prince. Now, obviously, decisively, I don't know if we ever clarified this, but you weren't working on the TV series, right? It was just the game.
I worked on both. I did stuff, mostly it was the game, but I also did work for like pre-production stuff for other ideas that were run through the pipe, because Wonderstorm had quite a few various ideas and like other shows they're pitching for other studios. So I would inevitably do concept art for those. I did a lot of the posters for the show, like I think the first few seasons.
The one that a lot of people see with the big dragon thing.
I've got it, like, I guess I can move my camera. There's right up there. So I did that one, and I think
you forget
I did, like,
we have technology, Tim. I can just insert a picture here.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Just drop
my camera's all messed up.
Yeah, you're good.
That is
you're
a little messed up, though. But yeah, so I did a lot of that stuff. And then there was... the big dream there was kind of to link the different multimedias, so taking show and game and kind of linking them together. We tried to do that a good bit with some success. And probably the most success we had, though, was working on board games and stuff that kind of fit between the two. So we create new characters. And I worked on those two. I art directed the somewhere around here. I'll have to figure out the name later. But it was like a... We did a few board games. We had like a D&D campaign book and stuff like that. For it wasn't D&D official rules, but it was another subset of rules, like Cortex or something. And those were pretty cool because they actually did link back into the game. We were going to make characters in the game and stuff. And then for the game, the teaser trailer was released, I guess maybe like, I don't know how long ago now, maybe like 6 months or something like that.
Yeah, something last year, I think it was
popular. Yeah, maybe last year sometime. But yeah.
But then, I mean, it's one of these things where, like, at least they give you the experience to do what you're doing now, which you've moved to a studio that, you know, you're doing something in a similar vein, but you've had that lot of experience. Because before then, you hadn't done much in the way of art direction heavily in a studio before, right?
I had done, let's see, 20. So I'd worked at a few studios at that point. One
it's
was
funny, we were talking about the whole Ready Dawn thing as well, right? But you weren't doing art direction there, right? It was
no, Ready Dawn was, that was all concept stuff. But then I did art direction for, there was a educational game I worked on.
Right.
That it didn't get released. There was issues there. Well, they had, technically there's two art directors, which was lots of disagreements.
I mean, you've got a bunch
of
stuff here. Like you've got DreamWorks, Ready Dawn, Network, Pocket Games, Axis Animation, videos.
Yeah. And there was another art direction. Oh, I also worked, there was another mobile studio I worked for doing art direction. It was Network. With three for the E. So I worked there for a little while too. But honestly, most of the studios that I worked at wasn't a great culture fit for me. And finding like a good culture fit was something I didn't look at as much early on in my career. Like I was sort of just like, oh, cool job, cool project, or just cool job at the beginning, or just job early on.
I mean, that's how you are when you start your career, though. You're just looking for those big tentpoles.
Anything.
I just want to work on something, like, want to be cool. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, Ready Dawn. Ready Dawn in itself were a really great studio as well. Especially.
Oh yeah, that was super fun. Like doing the concept art for them was really fun. And there was some other, like I worked for Playful for a while, and they had some really cool concepts I did. But
Axis as well.
Never seen
Axis
the light.
Are a huge studio. I mean, they're in Glasgow. They're over here. So like,
I worked on like for Axis. I did. I think some stuff might have got released, but most of the projects for Axis were. Shelved. They're all these projects that I didn't get to share. Any
happens. I mean, they're an outsourcing studio, so it's very rare. Very rare that they get to even show a lot of their work when you work at their studios, because a lot of the people you're working for will say, well, we don't really want you to release stuff. We just want you to work on the third party vendor stuff. And then just.
Yeah. And a lot of times they're doing pitches, I think, for other people too, where it's like.
Yeah, mobile games stuff as well. Trailers for mobile games or other things. They've got like Clash of Kings and stuff like that, and Clash Royale and do loads of stuff for that as well. I know people do stuff. So, they're a very multifaceted studio. They do a lot of stuff. So, I mean, like, it's one of these things where, you know, at least that, like you said, they gave you that experience and it gave you that perspective on, you know, what you're doing now if you go into a studio set.
Oh, yeah. Even, you know, even studios that like weren't the best experience, I learned so much from them. And I kind of, people have asked me like, oh, who's your mentor for art direction stuff? And a lot of times my answer is just like, well, all the bad experiences I did, I just do the opposite of that. And like try
Seems
to focus.
To work out.
Yeah. I try to focus on people most. And I've always seen everyone always focusing too much, I guess, not maybe not too much on the art, but just not enough on the people.
Yeah, of course.
And it feels like being an art director is just kind of like, it's a lot about the people. It's like making sure like you have a good relationship with them, that you trust them, they trust you.
They have the tools to do their job. You can get out of the way.
Yeah. You want them to feel safe when they're doing stuff, like to bring new ideas to you and, you know, not be shut down and stuff like that, just off for no reason.
I mean, it's always a thing, even just in management in general, not within art, but like managers are supposed to be, good managers are supposed to be the people who really just give you the tools to do your work and get out of the way. You know, just like,
yeah.
Anything I can be doing for you, anything I can help you with, and like, sure, as long as you're doing your
stuff. Yeah, a lot of times my job is like more heavy on the pre-production side, getting like the kind of established look. And then from there, it's more like just maintaining it and building everybody up and being like, oh, let's have some feedback here to get that quality bar way up there. Mm-hmm. Or just like maintaining the look and stuff. So it's,
it's one of these things. I think when you get to the level you have, is that it's the T we were talking about, but it's sometimes where like, you'll either go the art direction route, which is essentially management and constraint of the ideology and the vision, or you go principle, which is more just like continue to make art, basically.
Yeah, I think when I was younger, I think I assumed I'd do the principle side for quite a while and then go off and teach. Mm-hmm. But I ended up getting pulled into the art director side and really liking it. I like people, I guess, people. Working with artists. Like, I ended up liking people more than I thought I did.
No, I'm the same. Like, I mean, it definitely was initially in my career, making a lot of stuff and working for studios. It was the whole thing of like making a bunch of art. But I think always community has been a big thing for me, like with the podcast and with the Discord. Loads of other stuff that I've done, you know, like one of these things in the industry that people really realize early on is that I'm very well known in the industry. There's a lot of high up people in the industry that know who I am and know me by name and would know me to talk to me. But it's not my work that's ever carried my name. It's been the podcast. It's been the sociable side of me. It's been like just interacting with people. The fact that I can go up to anybody and talk to them, you know, like walking up to Raph and THU and talking to him and getting, you know, his contact details and
That's a tough skill to have. Like I'm not that great at that aspect. Like
I think when you're an extrovert in this industry, you're kind of king of the nerds. Cause like,
you know, that's true. I'm pretty far on the introvert, maybe ambivert side. So I tend to,
you've got a good middle ground.
Probably one of the tougher parts.
Yeah.
What was that?
You've got a good middle ground where like, you're not quite like just in your shell all the time. Cause you kind of can't be as introverted when you're an art director because you have to interact with so many people.
No, that was the biggest thing for me to overcome is because I, like when I was young, I was super introverted, like barely could kind of talk to people type thing. And so it was such a learning experience of just shifting over and getting into art direction roles.
And to know people and talk to them. And
being like, oh yeah, we're going to have a meeting with 30 whatever people. And realizing, sitting there at the meeting and being like, oh, I guess I'm in charge of this, aren't I? Sometimes the weight of that or just like the social anxiety that can come with that can be pretty tough to get over. But Any introverts out there, like, you can do it if you just, go to therapy and just build yourself up to it.
Even me to an extent, but I think I was so scared as a kid to talk to people. I think I almost forced myself just to talk to people. Like,
oh, that's what more, I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a hard time, like, looking people in the eye and stuff. Like, I was so shy. Yeah.
I know. It's funny when we think back now and I look at a lot of the TISM spectrum and you're always looking at like, oh, eye contact, that's a total thing. Oh, right, okay, yeah. Like the more you delve into those ADHD stuff as well, you're like, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And,
oh, there's so many things that I feel like, oh, that all applies to me.
Reading through the symptoms and you're like, oh, my God.
Yeah, it's like, maybe there's more.
That explains a lot of things, so yeah. Oh, God. It's funny though when you see people going through that whole, you know, because I'm going through it just now, the whole diagnosis thing, and when you get to that official thing, people talk about like the psychologist says like, oh yeah, I think you have ADHD or whatever. And you're like, you feel robbed. You feel like, you know, you look back at every interaction you've ever had with a friend or a relationship and you're like, oh, no wonder. Like no wonder
I was
like
all of it.
Explains so much stuff. Like, yeah. I mean, like it's definitely hard for me to make and keep friends, but I think it's also what I've realized is it's hard to keep normie friends. Like it's hard to have people who aren't like you, who are maybe like somewhere on the spectrum, I don't know, but like, you know, people who have the interest outside of like the normal stuff and like are quite geeky about that thing. And
Neurodivergent people are like, it's so easy for me to befriend neurodivergent people, but neurotypical people, I do have a harder time. Yeah. I think it's the overshare, right?
That's the thing I was trying to is the overshare is like when you talk way too much about something or you get like really enthusiastic and you get over excited about what you're talking about. And then 5 minutes in, you're like, oh shit, like, I need to stop. And then
I love that though, because like for me, I'm just like, oh look, I'm learning all this stuff. I need to know this person. Talking, I get so excited about that stuff. So it's like, oh yeah, go deep.
Have a niche thing, like it's, I mean, one of my, I say friends, like more an acquaintance at this point, but they were coming by to see the new flat we moved into. And they were looking at my art book collection. They were like, oh my God, that's a lot of books. I was like, oh yeah, well, they're concept art books. And he's like, oh yeah, concept art. So, you know, so there was a whole 5 minute rant on what concept art was, even though he didn't really want to know. He was like, all right, okay, cool. So art for games.
I see that you didn't ask, but let me tell you all about
it. Yeah. And then it's like, oh, but I've got this one you really, and I was like pulling out the books and like, check this one. This is really, and he was like, oh, that's really, you know, like trying to be probably polite and be like, you know, oh, cool. Yeah.
But you find another neurodivergent person, they're just like, yeah, let me set
like, oh my
up.
God, show me more. Like, what's your favorite top 10? Give me my top 10. And
yeah, I love hearing about people's special interest.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a thing because we have so many. You know, it's like a thing of when people say, do you have a hobby? I'm just like, yes.
Of course. Yeah. Do I have a hobby? Yes, I have too many hobbies.
Many hobbies. Yeah. But like even the fact that it was like the Ratchet and Clank art book from Insomniac, it was like, oh yeah, I think I've ever played that. And I was like, oh my God. And when I first met my partner that I'm with now, I think I went on like an hour rant about, because she wanted to get to know me. So she was talking about video games. She's like, so what's your favorite video game? And for me, that's like, I mean, obviously Zelda, but then it's like, there's so many games in the world. That,
like, yeah, like, plus this one, and plus this one, and plus this one.
And she was like, oh yeah, because, she was a big fan of the Twilight books growing up, so she loves vampires. So I was like, oh, well, actually, you know, I played this game back in the day, Legacy of Kain, which is also Soul Reaver. I think for like an hour, I basically laid out the whole synopsis of like six games of like how the story arc went on Legacy of Kain, because it's so cool, because he does
this. You'll have to tell me that sometime, because
he goes back in time and he meets Janice Hordern, who's the first vampire, and you find out how they were cursed. And that I honestly hope Crystal Dynamics bring that game back, because
I could see they could do a really good job, like bring that back.
They're talking about doing it. They put out a survey not too long ago, and the whole survey that I answered was like, I think it was like 30 questions on concise points, like what would you want to see in a sequel, like, what bits would matter most to you, like would it be story, character, combat, like but like
exploration, adventure, I think if they like
those games are always big on that as well. And
the story was always really great, like just kind of
originally written by Amy Hennig, who
I didn't realize
who went on
that,
to write Uncharted. So
okay, cool. That makes sense.
She was at Silicon Knights early on, and they wrote the story for that. So
I didn't know that. Oh, that's really cool. Yeah. Silicon Knights isn't around anymore, though, is it?
No, they went a long time
ago. Yeah, I remember there's some.
Because there was a whole war issues. When they made Soul Reaver by transferring the rights to from Silicon Knights to, was it Crystal Dynamics at the time? I can't remember if it was them or Eidos. It was one of them anyway, and they were trying to. There was a war for the rights, basically, to make Soul Reaver, to take the IP of Legacy of Kain and move it across to.
I think the final nail in the coffin, though, was they used Unreal Engine or something for some game, and then they were saying it wasn't using that. It was like something like that. But yeah.
One of the guys I know in Edinburgh, he worked on a reboot they initially started, but then it was like low key stuff. Like he was making keyframes, like really early stuff, and then it basically didn't get made. But they allowed him to put it in his art station. So I got to see, like, I'll maybe send it to you at one point, a bit of like the original ideas that we're thinking about. I don't think it was a continuation of Soul Reaver. I think it was something else. But this is what I'm talking about with divergence. The lore of Legacy of Kain.
We'll go deep into that, because I was a pretty big fan of those games. So,
yeah. I mean, the story in general, like if you didn't really take in the gameplay of all the hours, have to play it, but the story arc in general is really interesting. Oh, especially because now it deals with like time dilation and like multi-dimensional stuff. Is like stuff we're not talking about now in films, but
phasing between worlds and stuff. And then also it had the like intro cinematic or whatever for the first one had one of my favorite like voice actors. He was like this older guy, Joe something.
Oh yeah,
really deep awesome voice. Like,
is that the first Soul Reaver cinematic when he's like, I am Raziel, and they're like zooming in on the
I think so. Or it's like the narrator guy that's sort of like the god or something like that. But yeah.
Oh yeah. There's the funny thing is a lot of the voice actors for that game, we're just gonna dive into a 10-minute segment about Soul Reaver, by the way, guys. So just stick around. There was a whole bunch of really old actors, because voice acting at the time wasn't like it is now, with like a lot of younger people or people who at the time were younger got in it. it was a lot of old English voice actors they bought from like stage and screen to do.
Yeah, it was for this one. He was from like the History Channel. Like he did a bunch of History Channel narrations. Right.
Yeah, probably. So, yeah. There was a bunch of people in that. Even the guy who played Raziel at the time was fairly young. I think he was in his maybe early 40s, but he's kind of lived off that for a while because I've done a bunch after that as well.
Yeah,
the same guy, like the feel of like Ratchet and Clank, because the guy who does Ratchet's voice was the same guy who done Titus, I think it was, in Final Fantasy X.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So he got a bunch of work off that as well. But yeah, the games industry has definitely changed, and it now works must die because, like, obviously, you know, we talked about how you've not really worked as much on the games, but like you guys have like this protagonist thing now, and it's a whole thing with him as well. He's a whole character, and yeah, it's been a whole thing of like, you know, the main characters getting this whole like large of life and almost like animated stuff, like from animated movies. It's becoming a thing now in games. And
yeah.
So, yeah. But like, I mean, you went from, back on track, you went from Under Summer working on Dragon Prince. And Dragon Prince, of course, you know, the story was great. And a lot of the guys who worked on that were the original team who worked on Avatar Last Airbender and done stuff for that as well.
Yeah, like Aaron E. Haas and stuff was one of the founders of the studio. It was really great working with him on some of the
voice of Sokka originally, who then was on Dragon Prince as well. But then, so you left Wonderstorm and then went to Robot Entertainment, who are doing No Mercy Must Die. Was that a thing where they reached out to you, or did you reach out to them?
So this is actually the first. So I don't know if I talked about this before, but all my previous jobs I didn't apply for.
Right.
Like, people,
because you're too fucking good, that's what it is.
Well, the reason that happened was it was more because I was so shy and bad at interviewing. So I was like, I'll just make a really cool portfolio that speaks for me. And it worked out. But this job, I had a friend of mine, she reached out to me, and she was actually working at Robot Entertainment as well, and thought it might be a good fit. They were looking for a new art director, and I was looking kind of for a new studio, a new cultural environment, everything like that.
And did you talk to even about how LA at the time, you weren't really digging like the LA vibes as well?
Early vibes of...
No, the LA, Los Angeles.
Well, I love LA, but there's some aspects of LA where a lot of people you meet in LA, probably not the LA natives, but like the people that moved to LA.
Because nobody in LA is from LA.
Yeah. There's like, I have the best friends I've made in LA are LA natives, which are kind of harder to find at all.
Right,
neurodivergent, obviously.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But it kind of feels like in LA, everyone that looks at you, they don't see a person, but they see a ladder that they can climb to get to somewhere else. It's like, oh, you're a fine ladder. Like the amount of times where I'd be talking to people and they'd be treating me like a human, and then they would ask like, oh, what do you do? Which is such a common LA question.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's a general question too. Like I like to hear what people are doing too.
But now thinking about how we think about society is kind of like a weird thing to then be like, because you judge people solely on what they do for work, right? It's weird.
Yeah. Like to me, when I ask that question, I'm just like, oh, I want to know what you're into.
Generally
you
just like interested.
Yeah. But when it's asked in LA, it kind of means like, it's like, oh, are you a ladder I can climb? And I've been at like Halloween parties and stuff, and people are like, oh, what do you do? And then they go from like kind of like disregarding you or despising you to like just fawning. And like suddenly you're like, it feels disgusting. It's so
technically
gross.
Even though you've done more game stuff, like Dragon Prince, and again, because you've done more game stuff than that, but like it was on Netflix at the time, right?
So, So yeah,
people would
see that, or even just hearing the title art director,
right, yeah.
People would immediately just shift the way they talk to me, and I'm just like, this feels gross.
Because art directors also work in film sets, so yeah,
and anyone there, they're just like, oh, I can see you using you as a ladder to get somewhere else
to do something, yeah.
That yeah, and I then think... like if you're walking a sidewalk, most people in other places, like they'll, if this is a sidewalk, they'll go to the side,
right.
LA. They just stay in the center and expect you to go to the side.
Yeah.
So that explains LA pretty well. But I love all the food, the culture, the variety.
Very culture heavy place. And especially with, I think, the life you live with your partner, like it was very, especially the vegetarian stuff I've talked about and being a bit maybe neurodivergent, a bit colorful. Like it's definitely a city that embraces that. Yeah.
I love just like dressing up and wearing the most ridiculous outfits and or just looking at like a random like generated NPC walking outside and like people would compliment you because very open in that way. And then it's really great or easier to be if you're vegetarian, vegan or something like that.
Yeah.
So many options. You can be like, oh, do you want like Korean food, but the vegan version or whatever. Right, and it's just, you find a restaurant anywhere. So food is such an amazing thing.
Very on par. Yeah. We're good like that in the UK. Well, Scotland specifically. I know Edinburgh and Glasgow are very... Scotland in general, I think, is one of the vegan capitals of Europe because we have so many. Yeah, we have so much stuff in here.
That's cool.
Guy I used to hang about with, he still runs a vegan cafe, but it's like vegan junk food. So he makes like these huge burgers and fries loaded with stuff. Yeah, and it's all vegan, all plant based. Yeah. That's why it's called rabbit food, because he makes junk food for plants. So,
that's fun.
Yeah. But yeah, so LA, so I mean, but then you've moved the games because now you're where you are now. Obviously, Robot Entertainment, it's in Texas, right?
Yeah, so the Robot Entertainment, the studio is set up in Texas. We have, like, we call it Treehouse, like, hangout studio. Really, it's just like a few people hang out in there, work from there, but we'll do events and I'll come visit. But we're all over the country.
The country, right.
And all over the world, really. We have some
international
in Mexico.
Well.
Yeah, we're international. Like we've got East Coast, West Coast, North, South, and then also
other any countries. From like Europe and UK and stuff like that, or
No one in Europe, UK. We'd be willing to work with people from there, but we have someone from South America right now. But in the past, the other studios I worked with, lots of people from Europe and UK.
I think the remote culture is definitely like becoming more of a thing, like as COVID has.
Oh, it's fantastic! Like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, because like you said, like you're not in Texas, essentially. That's what we can see.
No, I moved out of LA. I'm up in a mountain now and just working off the forest. And yeah, so it's I love
definitely
the
your vibes.
Remote thing. Yeah. I don't really understand why there's this push to go away from remote now. Like I'm like, I think the world's changed enough. We should just accept it and let people have more time.
I think older studios, maybe people who have grown up with that culture in the 90s and 2000s feel like
it's really hard the only way you can be. But like our studio, everyone loves being remote. Everyone sees it as such a positive and kind of like it's the work-life balance is so much better. Like, you know,
well, no commute as well. Cause like even commuting in LA is a fucking nightmare.
Yeah. Like when I was in LA, I would try to like move next to the studio so I could just walk there and be like 10 minutes or whatever. But remote is just like, if you use communication, like a Miro board or something, you can all communicate, jump on Discord. We have all the tools we need and we get to spend so much more time with our loved ones, our pets, you know, all those things too, which to me, the older I get, the more important that becomes to me.
Yeah. It's like everybody I know who works either for Riot or Blizzard has to move within 5 minutes walking distance of those studios
because they kind of pulled that back in. Like, I think they still have some remote people, but I feel like that was really shitty of them to do. Like, it felt like
Blizzard particularly, I think they were really on top of that, of like bringing people back in. But I think that might be changing now, given the new management. I don't know. I don't know too much.
Hopefully,
about it.
Yeah, because it just seems to me it seems like it's a waste of so many things. Like, it costs more,
especially when they have contractors who work internationally, like across in the UK and stuff like that, and in Europe. Like, I don't know what the need is for teams to be on site all the time. I mean, it's fun, don't get me wrong. Like, I think you can do so much of that where you are remote and you eventually need some kind of human contact. So, like you say, you'll go to events or you'll go to things where there's going to be people in the studio, but you don't need it like every day. As long as you can get that fixed now and again, maybe once a month or something.
Yeah, that's kind of what we do. The studio flies me into Texas every once in a while. We get together and have like leads meetings or if there's like a big event where we're sort of like kicking something off or a launch party, things like that.
Because you're not bad from where you are, like the flight to Texas was a couple hours or something.
Yeah, it's just a couple hours, but I hate flying, so.
Oh, no. I'm not great either, but hey ho.
That's another story.
Yeah. So now you're at Robot and you're doing your new project. So, like, what did you feel like it was about the culture for Robot that made you want to move?
I guess it was more I was looking for a new, fresh culture, and the friend that recommended me to go there, like, I really trusted her kind of opinions and thoughts on it. She seemed really emotionally intelligent, and I was looking for a studio that really had very emotionally intelligent leaders, people that they could talk about the difficult things with their teammates and resolve issues, interpersonal issues and things like that. Like, I've been at a lot of studios where it gets kind of brushed under the rug, and then I think I'm probably neurodivergent, like I kind of have a really hard time letting things that I think are just hurt people or kind of harm people or mentally
wrong,
whatever.
Essentially. Yeah.
Yeah. When things feel really wrong to me, I I have such a hard time letting that go. Like
it's the justice drive. We talked about this other day. Like the whole thing of like needing the balance.
This, a strong sense of justice for things, and like I really like to try to hire really a diverse group of people that can kind of bring all new ideas and stuff like that. It just felt like those people in a lot of previous places weren't really heard out for problems, planning, and things like that. So I wanted someone that I felt could, or a studio that I felt could really hear me out when I'm like, oh, hey, we have an issue here. And instead of just washing it under conflict avoidance, face that problem.
All right, tackle head on. Yeah.
Yeah. Face it head, face on face or whatever there. Mm-hmm. Because to me, a lot of those interpersonal issues, they can start very small, but they kind of like cloud out like a mushroom cloud and kind of hang over you. And it just affects everything.
I mean, that's the whole reason that like Riot and Blizzard were going through what they were going through, because that stuff was just ignored for so long. Like,
it's and the longer you ignore it, the worse it gets, the worse it feels. And then like, it's just so rough.
It's difficult. And, cause you don't want to, I don't know. And maybe some people have this thing about, I mean, cause a lot of the people who run these studios and a lot of people who were high up were nerds originally, or people who founded these studios cause they wanted to make games.
Yeah. They usually went up through the, you know, the ranks, brackets and stuff. The ranks,
and then they maybe haven't had to deal with conflict in a way that, you know, that most businesses would. Cause I mean, like the thing is as well, I just talked with Darren the other day about how games essentially were born when I was two. Right. So in the '80s, like gaming was becoming a thing. So for an industry to prop up around that overnight and be where we are now, we're really lucky to have the jobs we have, I suppose. But at the same time, it's
such a young industry.
Yeah, so much is getting figured out. You know, like unions and like sexual harassment and HR and all that kind of stuff. Like that's, you know, it's, you know, the growing pains of the industry is what we're going through at the moment. I feel that's the thing.
I feel like there's just like some social things even outside of gaming that I think, you know, need to be worked on to make working environments a better place for everybody too. But gaming seemed like they're lagging behind even further than everyone else.
When I got into the industry, I think years ago, I always had this idea that it was so open-minded, and then because you make games and it was creative, that it would be a place where people would feel safe and would be, you know, it wouldn't be run like most businesses.
That's what my kind of thought early on was too. And I immediately, like some of the first studios, I ran into issues where it's like I'd have a cast of characters that were diverse, and they'd be like, well, let's remove all these characters that are diverse, let's focus on all these white characters over here. And I'm just like, oh my god, like really? Are you saying what I think you're saying to me? And but sometimes it's like it's just mind-blowing how like they try to act so nice about some of these things. It's just like
it's such a balance though, I think, within games as well, because you want to be diverse but not diverse for the sake of it. You want to make sure that
you want to be authentic.
You don't just plot people in for the sake of like ticking that box, you know, of like we are diverse.
That's the thing too. I think a lot of people, they assume when that's being pushed or whatever, but like when I'm thinking about it, I'm trying to represent the people that I know,
work around you.
Like the people I work around, my friends, the people that live around me in LA, like all that type of stuff. Like I'm trying to represent what I see as humanity. And I think a lot of people are like, oh, you're forcing and pushing it, but it's like, no.
It's just the way the world is. We don't live in like a really homogenous culture, unless you live in places like Japan, you know, where like it's mostly Japanese people. You know, and it's a thing like in most Western civilized world, especially places like LA, where it's a hub for just creativity in general, and everybody goes there to make their break into film or games or whatever.
Exactly.
You have people from all walks of life, all different genders, sexual orientations. So
And I think it's really important to represent those people in media, so that the next generation can see themselves in media and see themselves, so they can feel like they can reach out and either do that or feel more confident in themselves or feel less hated or whatever it is. I think just that representation is super important.
Just that feeling of seeing the character on screen that represents you, and you're like, oh, that person can do it. So like,
You and I, our whole lives, we've had endless amount of games that we are represented in over and over and over again. So it's like, I don't think we need to keep
time for someone else.
It's time for some other people to have like, representation.
It's like Bo Burnham when he done the inside joke, and he's like, you know, white people have had the floor for like 400 years, so we should just shut the fuck up.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't want to do that. It's
like, I'm bored.
I'm bored. Yeah. But it's one of these things where like, it is 100%. Like, oh my God, I was thinking about that song as well, where he sings about the Aladdin costume. So I'm going to go home and burn it. Or not burn it? Should I burn it? I don't know what I should do. But Yeah, but it's a thing where, like, yeah, it's a thing that needs to be addressed and has to have a balance. But again, it's the overcorrection of, like, the industry being so young and trying to get things done and really, like, force those things in only because for so long the doors have been shut to that stuff. So people are trying to really just push it through as much as they can just now until then it eventually bounces out again.
So, and for me, it's not even like I, when I hire, I try to think of that same aspect of diversity. So I want to represent it on my team and externally. Sometimes you can't always do that. Like, I inherited a team more so when I moved to Robot Entertainment, and they're all fantastic. Like, I've really gotten to know them and it's been really fantastic. But like, even that was kind of a new experience for me because most of the studios I've worked at, I started as like the artist, and then it's like, okay, now build the team and hire everybody and interview everybody. So you really get to know and get to know everybody in the opposite way where they're getting to know you and you're getting to know them. But in this situation, I was kind of like tossed into the mix, and it's like, well, here's your team. I might have to hire a few people here and there. And so that was another unique experience with moving to Robot, where it felt like it was just another challenge I hadn't faced before.
And now, you know, the way the landscape's looking with things like AI, and obviously, like, you know, we talked about it early on about how that kind of sits, and, you know, people with portfolios, and I'm just wondering how the games landscape is going to look in the next couple of years, and thinking about, you know, what will be the skills that are needed. And, you know, and I think it's interesting with the tech sector, because, I mean, tech in general, because half the jobs that will be needed in the next 5 years don't even exist now. Like, things just prop up because they become a job out of necessity. Even like, you know, people who are now cultural experts that work on teams because they need the aspect of something representing the game. But even the concept, like, it's a thing where I feel like the traditional skills are really what you should be focusing on all the time. Like, in anything you do, like, it is always foundations in what you do, like, you know, perspective, anatomy, color, composition, all that kind of stuff. It's
expands your mind, really.
Yeah, like, the most successful people I've seen in every industry and every part of the game sector are people who, like, really focus on and double down on those huge key skills early on. Like, those are the people that get noticed really quickly. And Tim's, like you said, you're walking evidence of, like, everybody who always asks me, every student ever comes to me ever in the last 5 years is, how do I get noticed? How do I make a portfolio that gets noticed? And I'm like literally just, you make stuff that is good. If your portfolio is good enough.
A lot of times I think the mistake I see is kind of like people are trying to make stuff that appeals to other people. And I think that's, or appeals to, like, they're trying to be too broad and open to it. And that ties into the social media thing too, where you're like, you'll be like, oh, this got a lot of likes, so I'm going to do this now. And it's like, 100%. That can lead you into places that you end up not really liking what you're doing. And
you have to be true to yourself. You really have to.
Exactly. The most impactful stuff that I felt like I've done is the stuff where the personal projects where I just went off on a, you know, over here and started building a story and was really cohesive about it and tried to just keep building that up. And it's my own thing. And it was that's what got me noticed. And I think that applies to, like, everyone's portfolio, to where it's like, you don't want to necessarily copy what everyone else is doing. You want to do something unique to you, something that pulls from your individuality and stands out. And I think that's what separates us, you know, from,
well, storytelling in general. I mean, I feel like storytelling is something that really isn't, like, grained into people's work, but, like, so much of the stuff, you know, like the Sanctuary Tomb, or you've done, like, stuff at Cabin in the Woods, like, older pieces obviously, but, like, it feels like a page out of a book. Like, you could look at that and say, oh, I wonder where, who lives in the cabin? Where's the tomb?
Yeah. What happened before? What happened after?
Yeah. Like, that's
happening now. Yeah.
Even to, like the little person, big structure is a trope, obviously, but, like, the storytelling aspect of someone looking into a piece and being like, I wonder what's going on, like, behind the scenes. Like, when you know, even like in the Cabin in the Woods, if you even had, like, a little guy with a torch at one point, and then people are like, oh, like, someone's going to investigate the cabin. Like, that stuff is what then brings in art directors, because they're like, it was like, you know, I'm going to have at this point, you know, I can kind of announce it, but Jason Schreier is coming on, and he worked on Blue Eyed Samurai. And the reason that he really got that gig was obviously because his work was incredible at the time, but there was so much story depth in what he was making at the time as well. And that was what really drew Netflix to him to make that project, because he had a lot of that vision, stuff figured out. Yeah. Yeah, it's something I think missing from most modern portfolios, and you know, it's it depends what you want to work in as well, because even within concept design and 2D, there are so many jobs, you know, between storyboards and keyframe design to, like, the blue sky stuff. But then if you want to do concept design, it's like, you know, more prop stuff, environment stuff, you know, there's a whole, like, deconstruction happening there with the stuff you build. But yeah, everything but you do,
every layer of that should have story.
Yes. It
should have purpose, meaning, and story.
And should be true to you as a person.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, one of these things is that I feel like is, if you're not really pushing that button early on, when you get to the roadblocks of crunch, if you have to go through it, or like projects that are really a bit longer, or maybe it isn't something you really want to work on, like if you have that ability to be doing something at least you really enjoy or that speaks to you as an artist, that will really like help you through those harder moments. Like I listened to an interview with Lady Gaga when she was on a radio show. There was a clip, it was only a couple of minutes long, but she talked about how artists don't really even need like discipline or the hard work aspect of what they do. What they need is perspective. It's the thing where you need to have a vision of like what you want to be as an artist, as a person, and that will hopefully keep you on track. Because if you jump from one thing to the other, for what people like or what people think you should be doing, which I have been guilty of long for so long, you know, try to copy The Last of Us 2 sketches that came out at one point and try to learn Blender because everybody was learning it. Like,
yeah,
you know, you have to really sit there and ask yourself, do I want to fucking learn Blender? Do I even want to learn Blender? You know what I mean, like, yeah. You really, like, I went back into Maya and done that whole thing the last couple of weeks because I was like, well, I'm good at Maya and I'm really quick at it, so why the fuck should I just not use that? I mean, it's like, just do whatever. Like, I know a woman who runs a studio called Athena Studios, and it's like she does all her concept art in Unreal. She was like, I was so sick of like drawing, I didn't really want to do that, but I knew I was good at 3D and I really loved Unreal Engine, I was really quick at it. So I was like, fuck it, I'll just make concepts in that. Whatever. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like,
I mean, for me, I struggled with perspective here and there. So I used a lot of 3D, and then the 3D helped me learn perspective better. And I inevitably just like walked away from the 3D and stuck with 2D for the most part. But I'll probably go back as well. But a lot of that was more chosen to kind of fulfill that goal that I had up here. Mm-hmm. That to me, it's always an ever moving goal, but having that goal and kind of sticking to that, being like, not like wavering maybe to trends as much and kind of flip-flopping, and that's always the most like responses and impact I've gotten has always been the stuff where I've really just like ventured myself. And
I mean, it's the most common complaint you see with people with portfolios, how you look at a portfolio and you'll see like a bunch of environments, because obviously this art station thing, and then like, somebody would be like, oh, that's great, do you want to be an environment artist? And they're like, nah, not really.
That's always, yeah, only put work you love in your portfolio. Like,
yeah, as soon as you get an offer to get hired for someone, and people are like, oh, so this environment work in your portfolio, do you want to get paid for it? And they're like, not really. Like, I'll probably take the gig because it pays money, but, and then you end up with more professional stuff that you've done as environment, and then you're even further in the rabbit hole.
Exactly.
You can't go back now. Because even I was listening to Adam Duff talk, and he was talking about, you know, Lucid Pixel, he was talking about, he has a mentee at the moment, and she was like, yeah, I really want to do some creature and character work, like that's a whole thing I want to do. And and then she's like, well, why have you got environment stuff in your portfolio? And she's like, oh, you know, because, you know, environment work, it's, you know, it's probably where you'll get the most work, and it's probably how I'll get hired the quickest. And he was like, all right, well, if you want to do environment stuff, like I can give you Tyler Edlund's, you know, number and like give him a call, because he's obviously the master at what he does there. But like, yeah, there's no point like mentoring with me if you want, because I'm a creature artist and a cat artist.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, so it's not
going
to make
you're shifting directions and you're going creature stuff. Yeah.
And she was like, oh yeah, but then I really want to do character. And he's like, oh, okay, then it's like, it's the thing of like, I chased it for years, and you know, also we've been friends for a long time, and you know, I'm always shifting the goalpost of like, what will get me hired quickest.
Yeah.
And nobody really, or even not me, have sat down and been like, what do you want to do, Gordon? What do you want to do?
I think that's the, I always, my saying is slow and steady gets the spaghetti. And you know, have that goal and just keep chipping away at it. And it feels slow at the time. It feels slow at the time, but if you just keep going towards it, you'll get there. And it's so easy to get, you know, fall off track and be like, oh, I'm going to go do this or go do that. And although, you know, right now I feel like I'm in a little bit of one of those spots where I'm really interested in this thing over here, this thing over here, this thing over here. So maybe something's new on the horizon for me. We'll see.
Yeah. It's one of these things where I think you try to fill the blank space in your life with something interesting, because you don't want to maybe sit in the emptiness, because it feels like a bit like too dark. Cause you're like, oh, I'm not really doing something I can, because I feel like I talked about this with, not even the neurodivergent stuff, but even being a creative, right? Being a creative person. I watched a podcast where somebody talked about how if you don't fill that space with work or fill that space with being creative, you overanalyze your life to the point you'll start to invent these scenarios in your head, and then you spiral like down this hole of that every worst case scenario. Yeah. I was watching it and I was like, oh shit, like that's totally what happens.
yeah, the like there's that innate need to create, and then if I don't do that, like I don't feel that great. Yeah.
Just deeper and deeper down the hole, and you're like, oh,
feel
yeah.
A little
and
empty then, if I don't.
And at one point, the world's going to end, and the sun's going to envelop the planet. And like, oh, shit. You're like, get me out of here. What the fuck am I doing?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's easy to fall into that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me, like, I've been branching out of my creative fulfillment too. I want like a hobby that I don't get paid for.
Right.
As well. So.
Well, that's why you said you're doing music as well, right?
Yeah.
I've got a piano as well. I just haven't really used it in a while, but like I do want to learn music. But it feels like until I conquer the molehill that is, you know, or the mountain that is my creative career in art, like what I'm doing just now, like until I've really got that like settled, I don't feel like I can move things. Yes.
I agree with that. Like I feel like I'm in a spot where I just want to branch out and evolve in some other directions and music.
I mean, if I'm honest with myself and the stuff I want to do, the thing I want to do, I don't think is the thing that would ever get me hired. But that said, everybody I know who's ever gotten a cool job is like, well, I just done the thing I really enjoyed and eventually somebody will hire me.
Slow and steady, man. Get some spaghetti. Just keep, like, you can kind of turn anything into a career if you're dedicated enough to it.
Yeah.
And it's, a lot of times it's more like specific and unique rather than generalized. Like games that are successful, the ones that are really good are the ones that are specific visions intended for a group of people and
niche,
niche stuff that really identifies with that group of people. If you try
it's not like Call of Duty where it's like this mainstream appeal, but like there is a probably really dedicated following to that game because it's still around. So
it's a unique combination of like third person action and like tower defense.
And I
don't see too many tower defense games at least set up that way, so I think
the last one I played that was really good was a VR one where literally you would go into the level with giant hands and you would place the turrets on I like those interactable things like the VR stuff like that.
I've got a VR headset I've been playing around a little bit, but
I just got a Quest 3.
That's what I've got too. I have a hard time staying in VR though because it's so heavy, and also
I need to get lenses for it. There's a company that makes custom lenses, so if you wear glasses you can get lenses so they just literally slot onto the headset. You just push them on and then you don't have to wear your glasses in VR, you just put it on your head.
That'd be nice. Yeah, that's the other thing. It's like it always like squishes your glasses to your face, and then I get like,
that's why I want to get the lenses,
because oil your glasses quarter and you're just like, oh, can I clip my glasses again?
But VR is interesting because like there is an almost untapped potential in that industry right now because there's not a lot of great content. One I would recommend,
there's a lot
for
that can
you
be done though.
Well, if you've got the Quest 3, I would recommend Demio because that's a huge game. So Demio is, it's like a tabletop board game thing, but like you literally are in someone's basement, but you can zoom in and go right into the board and move your pieces individually. But like, it's like a board game where you move people, you roll dice, and then you attack, essentially. But it's done so well. Like that, there's a whole culture and community behind it. They even have like little hangouts in the game. You can now, they made this thing called Heroes Hangout where it's like a old school like board game shop you go into. Can all hang out there with your friends. We need to play at one point. We'll definitely check it out.
Yeah. Well, I've got the set. We should definitely play.
Because you can also, there's a figure painting thing in the back room. You can paint figures, like little like figures from the game, like trolls and stuff.
That's so cool.
Like airbrushes and paintbrushes.
I think that's one of the reasons I ended up in games, because I used to paint little figures.
Measures.
They're lead though, so I hope that doesn't affect me in the future.
but Demio has all that stuff, but then the actual board game itself is great because it's like you pick from different classes like warlock, wizards, whatever, barbarians, move them about the board, but the board sits in front of you and you can move about the board obviously to see it. But if
really
you do
cool.
an AR, because the MetaQuest has the AR function, you can place the board in your room and then walk about
the board. The AR things are pretty, I like some of that stuff, it's pretty cool. It seems really like the advanced. VR would be perfect for like a, I don't know if you remember the God Sims used to be really popular, like Black and
White.
There's
a bunch of them.
Like
so they just launched Tropico on Quest 3, which is like the old kind of God Sim, like, I don't know, Tropico is a weird thing. I can't remember where it falls. It's almost like the Civilization.
I feel like it's like almost like between like an RTS and like a, I haven't played really it too much.
Strategy
but
stuff,
it's like,
But like, I mean, it's funny that like there's so many, the Quest 3 is, it really is on tap, but there's really good games that come out recently, like even like Breachers, because I used to play a lot of Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six Siege, and there's basically Breachers is that for VR, going through doors and windows and stuff like that with guns and shooting other people. So Quest in general is, and also for painting, like there's there's Gesture VR, which is LifeDrawn for
Oh really, I haven't seen that one.
So literally you get a, like something like 50 models you can flick through, but they sit on a stand and you get an easel and a pencil and you can draw with it.
That's really cool.
And it's interesting. So there's Gesture VR, there's Vermilion, which is a painting app, and you get a whole thing of paints and brushes and you can paint, and the brush engine's really good. It's really good for like feeling like paint on paper and stuff.
I've done like Tilt Brush and like some of the sculpting ones and stuff, but
because there's Gravity Sketch and stuff like that. But like Vermilion and Gesture VR are good because they're 2D based, so like the gesture is just pencil and paper, like drawn, life drawn stuff
just on 2D.
You
get most of the other ones are like awful 3D.
But it's hard though because you hold the easel with the left one and you paint or draw with the right. But you don't get the feedback obviously of like paper, so it's like, you know, you're trying to guess, but then because of the haptics, because of the vibration stuff, it kind of, you feel when the pen hits. That Gesture VR and Vermilion are really two of the best, because also they're co-op, so you can actually, if you both have the headset, you can sit in those games and do drawing or painting.
you need a physical device that you just like have like a pen that you scratch on, just so it's
essentially like people AR have actually done it where they've put like a board on top of the left one, and then you will feel it like stop like to draw, but it's a weird thing. But it's kind of hard to judge, but the art things are there definitely, but anyway, we're digressing. So you've caught up, you're a robot now, and we've talked about like AI, we've talked about portfolio and things that mean much to you. So I think that's a good place to wrap up. I think, you know,
there was some other things I've been working on that I was going to mention too. Like I've got one of the big time sinks that I've been kind of sinking all my time into is taking all of my art, making new art, and then making this whole like art lore book where it's kind of in done from the perspective of someone in one of my worlds.
Okay.
And then I almost want it to be kind of like, I don't know, when you're a kid, did you ever get those books where it's like dragon books or like castle books, and you'd get in like just like sink into it, and they're really powerful and meaningful to me when I was younger, and I kind of want to take that and create one out of my world and everything,
right? Yeah,
which, you know, could inevitably turn into something else, but for me, I think a book sounds like a fun project. Like I want something kind of physical to outcome from this. And it's pretty far along. So
yeah, I'm doing something similar to that. I think we talked about this point where I'm playing, you'll hear about it now, obviously you might even see it at this point in the podcast, but I'm filling a sketchbook with drawings from Legend of Zelda, in the sense that I'm playing the game and then filling in a journal.
Drawing as you go through.
Perspective of like Link and what he's like, he finds the book in the shrine.
And then cool. Yeah.
Like when he comes across stuff, he's drawing it and being like, oh, this, I found this thing today when I was walking. So like,
Awesome. Yeah, that's kind of how mine's done. Like I have like, there's like a character that this other character is following that's in the world, and sort of figuring out like what the story is, and then letting people kind of interpret that.
There was a painter I knew done that at one point where he made a whole book basically on because people had really done like Earth to Death, but he talked about how like when painters used to go around the world, it used to be a thing where they would find paint was in front of them, they go around the world and paint was in front of them, then photography became a thing. But he tried to do it where the book was basically about someone landed on an alien planet, and then they painted everything they saw on the alien planet. George something, he's a British painter but very famous for sci-fi novels and stuff like that, but he done a whole book like that. But I'm doing it from the perspective of like Link just walking around the world and then finding things.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, I look forward to seeing that.
So you've got your book, and then like are you doing anything with your game also, your card game, Moss, is that still
Cycles of Moss? Yeah, that's on a pause right now. There was some differencing of opinions with my business partner, so
technical difficulties.
Technical difficulties. I probably, if I redo it, I might do it as a different type of game but using the similar art and stuff like that, but I haven't decided where I'm going with that. I do have some ideas around it, I just haven't like had time
executed on them yet. Yeah, because you're also working a full-time job, so it totally makes sense.
I just moved too, so I'm settling in a lot and kind of just putzing around with different things here and there. Still drawing, but not as much as I want to. I want to get back into doing.
I'm the same.
Sketching.
I'm trying. This is why I'm doing the Link project, because I'm trying to like force myself to sit down and do something cool, drawn wise. Yeah. Just to get the muscle working. So
I ebb and flow, because I'll get burned. I usually burn myself out, is what happens. Like I go too hard for too long, draw too much, which it's hard to find that balance, because like when you're on that cusp of like, oh, this feels really good. I'm drawing tons, loving all I'm making. And then you get to that, like, the edge of the black hole, and it sort of pulls you in, and you get stretched out, and you feel way burnt out. So I'm really bad at repeating that, so I'm trying to be more balanced.
Yeah, I think it's also the thing where, like, in modern day culture, you feel like you should be doing, like, every part of your day should be filled with something. Like,
And that doesn't have to be true. Like, now I'm, you know, like, birds show up outside my window, and sometimes I'll just sit there and watch birds show up at the window. And
you need to get one of those feeders. Oh my god, there's one where it's like you stick it to the glass, but then the it's like a little box that goes out the way, but then it's
a clear box. I want to get those because we've got our two cats and they love watching the birds, and I want to get one where it, like, it sticks out.
Yeah.
Or there's one where it sticks in, and then the birds will come into the window and then, like, eat the food and stuff.
Essentially, yeah, like, you put a little bird food in the side, and then have to fly inside it, and then or it's like it's opaque on the outside, so it keeps the light out, but then the glass is obviously flush with the glass, so when they come in, you can still see them. Someone done that last year, and
two-way mirror.
They filled it forever, and then the birds ended up coming and making a nest and laying eggs and everything, and, like, filmed them, like, the chicks hatching and everything. I was like, oh my god, incredible. Like, making little mini nests in their windows, it was incredible. So awesome. Cool, right, okay, so if you guys have made it to this point in the podcast, thanks for staying on and listening to us rant about fucking everything. I don't know what we've not talked about at this point. Like, say, KNA, IVR. Who knows, something might be cooking in the works in the future, we don't know. So meantime, I've talked about doing another podcast, but we're not sure about what it's going to be or what it's going to happen, but I think it would be a cool idea because we have a lot of the same mindsets on things, so it'd be cool have a back and forth. So if you've got to this point, thanks for listening. Thanks for Tim for coming on again and giving up his time. I know this is your lunch hour and it's really into your work, but it was great that I got to catch up.
Yeah, it's fantastic chatting, and if anyone wants to find me online and stuff, I'm at Random Spirits at most, pretty much all the social medias, and like timkaminsky.com for most stuff, so usually pretty easy to find. But
I'll leave all the links and stuff down below, you guys can find them pretty easily enough, so
technology.
Check them out, yeah. So again, definitely for hanging out, thanks for you guys for hanging out, and for Tim for talking, and we'll speak to you guys later. Bye.
Awesome. Bye.